Oh, no, I didn't do it. Anyway, if it gives you too much feedback, we'll do something. So let me just, which one are you? Long-term effects. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Okay, thank you, Al. So we added this topic this year that we didn't have when we gave this course at Columbia or at Harvard. We thought that we needed to fill in some of the gaps. And so this topic will cover these two areas of effects on the developing embryo and fetus and heritable effects. We didn't cover heritable effects last time, and there were questions about it afterwards, so we thought we should put it in. But first, radiation effects on the developing embryo and fetus. Now, we know that quite moderate doses of radiation can produce catastrophic effects on the developing embryo and fetus, with the effects depending critically on the stage of gestation as well as the dose and the dose rate. Now, there are three effects that are observed and that we will look at one at a time. There's growth retardation, where the newborn is smaller than it should be. There are congenital malformations, which are perhaps the most worrying endpoint. And then there is death, embryonic, fetal, or neonatal death, death occurring at various times during development. And we look at each of these, and I want to be sure to distinguish what we know from human studies and what we know only from animal studies. Now, conventionally in the textbooks, gestation is divided into three principal periods, namely pre-implantation, which in the human is the first 9 or 10 days, where the fertilized, before the fertilized egg implants, and when it's a limited number of cells. Then there's organogenesis, the period when individual organs and tissues are differentiating. And in the human, this occupies a period of 10 days to 6 weeks. And then there's the fetal period, which is long in the human, from 6 weeks to term. And now, these are the conventional distribution of periods during gestation, but some of the radiation effects don't seem to take this into account. They don't obey the basic rules, so it seems. First of all, growth retardation. Now, this is not observed following irradiation during pre-implantation. Now, this can often be quite important when individuals are exposed to a lot of medical x-rays, and it turns out that it was shortly after conception during pre-implantation. At this point, it's an all-or-nothing effect. Either the newly fertilized egg is killed or nothing else. You don't see growth retardation. You don't see abnormalities, and that's important. And that's been observed in many animal studies and also in human studies. Now, the next one is strictly animal studies, namely that in irradiation during early organogenesis leads to growth retardation that is expressed at term, but from which the animal recovers by the time it gets to be an adult. So this is temporary growth retardation. But then irradiation during the fetal period results in a large degree of permanent growth retardation. Now, that is also observed in the human as well as in animal studies. So the middle one is strictly animals. The first and the third are human as well. Now, here's certainly, it's a very crude observation, but nevertheless fairly convincing, of growth retardation at Hiroshima. It goes all the way back to the 1980 Beer report, where something like 80% of the 1,600 children exposed in utero were followed. And they looked at those who were within a mile. It started off as a mile, but then they went metric, 1,500 meters of the hypocenter, compared with those that were more than 2 miles, more than 3,000 meters away. And on that crude comparison, those who were exposed are shorter by a couple of centimeters, 3 kilograms lighter, and in particular, have got a smaller head diameter by about a centimeter. And the average Kermer, but this is average because this is everybody lumped together, the average Kermer is about 0.25 of a gray, but there's a wide range of doses. But this clearly shows growth retardation due to irradiation in utero in the human. Now we get on to the next much more controversial point, and that is the malformations. And a lot of animal experiments have been done. In our lab, when I arrived in the 1960s, there were a lot of these studies going on with Roberts Roux and colleagues at the time. And they found that if you irradiate during pre-implantation, here's what we said before, it's an all or nothing, you get death or nothing. But when you cross the line from pre-implantation into organogenesis, then the number of congenital malformations from, this is a big dose of radiation to make the experiment easy, it goes up to essentially 100%. And they could pick a day in organogenesis to irradiate and get an abnormality in a different organ or a different tissue. Prenatal death switched to neonatal death, that is death at or about the time of birth. And then when you went out of organogenesis, nothing in the fetal period, because in those days nobody thought to do IQ tests on the mice. So they didn't find anything in the fetal period, but they've gone back since and looked, and it's there. So these experiments with mice showed this big, sensitive induction of congenital malformations during this discrete period of organogenesis. This is all in the mouse. Here we see typical horror pictures of a brain developing outside the skull, evisceration, no brain developing at all, resorbed embryos. And as I say, a particular malformation is characteristic of a particular day during organogenesis when irradiation is given. The rat experiments are essentially the same. Even 100, that's the gray, and that's the old units, 100R, because these are old experiments, produce no malformations, but immediately you go into organogenesis, you get essentially 100% malformations, and then in the fetal period, it's growth retardation. Again, you can pick your day and irradiate in gestation and get a particular malformation in rats, and this one is inability of the eye to develop. Now we come to the Japanese survivors, and one of the things that was early noticed was that they had smaller head diameters. Now these pictures are used to be hard to come by because the Japanese were very protective of the people that were survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they didn't allow many studies on them. But this clearly was an endpoint to be observed. And this is a complicated three-dimensional plot where you've got gestational age and dose and percentage with microcephaly, small head diameter. And the bottom line is that you can produce microcephaly for quite a period during gestation, not confined to organogenesis, and of course it goes up with dose. Now, a head that's just slightly smaller is not as disastrous as the next endpoint, which is mental retardation. Now, this these data that come from the early studies are somewhat less than optimal because in those days, the Japanese government wouldn't allow IQ testing on the children. And so we've only got severe mental retardation. That's the only score. That is bad enough that the child had to be brought up in an institution, not in their own home. So this is severe mental retardation. Now, we really need the old-fashioned dual projection here because I'd really like to have this picture with the next one. So keep this in mind, and we'll go to what the various committees say about these data. They say the incidence of severe mental retardation as a function of dose is apparently linear without threshold for this period, 8 to 15 weeks. Now, you notice that that's not during the classic period of organogenesis. It's a bit beyond that. So apparently linear without, well, is it? Let's go back. Well, I suppose you could, these have got such big error bars, you could put a ruler through these points and it'll go through the origin. So it's apparently linear. And you notice what the risk estimate is. At a gray here, it's about 40%. So that was their conclusion. 40% per gray. But then they say, it is also consistent with a threshold of about 0.2 gray. So if you look back, that's perfectly true. You can put a ruler through these points and look for a threshold. And there are some arguments about these low dose points. You notice that this dose point, for example, the standard error includes zero. And there were also some of the cases of mental retardation involve trisomy. So this can't possibly have been due to a radiation at the during in utero. That takes place at conception. So there are some questions about these low-dose points. And so now we get to the mechanism. What is the mechanism of this mental retardation? And the mechanism is summed up here, that you get later MRI studies. Now, there was no such thing as MRI in the 1940s, 50s, or even 60s. They can go back in retrospect and look at these that were in utero in 1945 and are now adults, and you can see massive impairment of the ability of cells to migrate from the region in the brain where they are produced to the region in the brain where they function. And that appears to be the mechanism. Cells are killed during the time that they are migrating from where they are produced to where they function. So this would fall into the category, you think, of a deterministic effect. If you kill just one or two cells, it's probably not going to matter much. And so that is consistent with the notion that the data look as if there could be a threshold. And for the medical use of radiation, of course, that's very important, because many standard medical procedures are less than 0.2 gray. So that's a very important point. Beyond this 8 to 15 weeks, 16 to 25 weeks, the risk is about four times lower, but it's still there. Now, later on, as Japan became more liberal, studies could be done now on these children that had become adults, and it appears that a dose of about a gray results in a loss of something like 20 to 29 IQ points. So this is something that persists well into later life. Now, we're always happier when you can find data from elsewhere that tends to support these data. And there was an article in 2004 by Per Hall and group, an allegedly reputable group of epidemiologists in Sweden. And they looked at a cohort of children. Well, they were naughty. They only looked at boys, I believe. Anyway, they looked at a group of children who were irradiated when they were children for the treatment of hemangioma of the skull. Now, these were treated, some with radium plaques, some with soft X-rays, and inevitably, the brain got a small dose of radiation. And this is what they found. They found that a dose of more than 100 milligray affected the performance of these boys in the examination that is required in many European countries to go from one school to the other, namely to go to high school. Not the sort of thing we do in the United States, but many countries in Europe stream children at the age of about 10 or 11. And so the percentage that go to high school is a measure of cognitive impairment. And so they found that more than 10 RADs could be measured in terms of those who went to high school. And then they also looked at other measures, other cognitive tests, and found that there was a dose response curve for doses above that. And then, must not forget the study of the previous speaker, Elaine Ron, and her group, who looked at the children who got bigger doses, children that were epilated with x-rays for the treatment of ringworm of the scalp. But of course, this was a big dose of 1.4 gray, and not surprisingly, you could see various effects, including an increase in brain tumors. But that's a bigger dose. So, to summarize what we've said so far, animal experiments show critically, these are the most important things, embryonic death during pre-implantation, but nothing else, all this growth retardation, and most importantly, the animals show this dramatic incidence of gross congenital malformations during organogenesis. And by contrast, the Japanese survivors certainly show microcephaly from irradiation during quite a big period of gestation. They show severe mental retardation, particularly 8 to 15 weeks, which is not exactly, which is beyond organogenesis, but there's no sign of all of the malformations that are commonly seen in the animal experiments. And this has provided a topic for a lot of discussions and a lot of arguments. This diagram points out the difference. Here in the animal data, you've got all these congenital anomalies. That's missing in the Japanese. And what you see in the Japanese is mental retardation, which in the early animal experiments, as I said, was never measured. Now, there's a lot of argument about why there is this apparent contradiction, and there are two different explanations that are advanced to account for this. One of them is that most of the men were away at the war, and so there weren't that many, considering the size of the town, there weren't that many irradiations in utero, something like 1,600 in Hiroshima, and that since gestation is so long in the human, there weren't enough at any given time to show a statistically significant increase in malformations. That's one explanation. The other explanation is that in Japan, in 1945, 95-99% of babies were born at home with midwives, and a child that was obviously deformed wasn't allowed to live, and there were no U.S. epidemiologists there at the time when these children would have been born. They didn't come in until later. And so if there was an excess, it was missed because there was nobody looking at the whole picture. So I think, nevertheless, it would be very foolish to assume that the human is different to all other animal species that have been studied. And all animals studied show this malformation during irradiation during organogenesis. And I think we've got to assume that in the human, that this period of risk extends all the way from the end of pre-implantation right through organogenesis and into this fetal period. All of that is a time of risk. Now we're going to switch to the other topic that we didn't deal with in the last course too, which is hereditary effects of radiation. And by this, we mean adverse health effects in descendants due to mutations induced in germ cells, as opposed to the somatic effects that I talked about this morning. And one of the first and important points to be made is that radiation does not produce new, unique mutations, but increases the incidence of the same mutations that occur spontaneously. Also, information on the genetic or hereditary effects of radiation comes almost, not completely, but almost entirely from animal experiments. It's different to the carcinogenesis story, where we've got so much human data. So this picture, which was common in the comic books back in the 50s and 60s, where radiation produces these bizarre mutants, is just not on. Radiation doesn't do it. You see people like this around radiology departments, but it's not due to the radiation. Now, the fact that ionizing radiation is a mutagen was first shown by Muller in 1927 using the original radiation martyr, Drosophila the fruit fly. And what he found is that radiation increases the spontaneous mutation rate. There was no evidence of a threshold, and perhaps more important, and I should add it here as another bullet, in the fruit fly, there was no effective dose rate. Whether you gave the dose all in one shot or spread out over a period of time, it didn't make any difference. You got the same mutation rate. Now, there's been a changing scene, which Dr. Brenner referred to in his talk. I didn't know he was going to mention that, but because I've got it in here. In the 1950s, genetic effects, as we call them in those days, now we call them heritable effects because everything is genetic, they were thought to be the most significant consequence of exposure to radiation. That's what we were worried about in those days, because the excess cancer incidence in the Japanese A-bomb survivors had not shown up. And that is very different from today. And what's happened over the years is that in the 50s, based on the Drosophila data, we were very worried about the genetic effects. That's what we thought was all important. And then after World War II, we were a bit worried that Drosophila was the basis of all our radiation protection standards, and so the mouse data came in. And the mouse data reduced the worry because there's a big dose rate effect in the mouse, like there is in everything else we study. And so the importance of heritable effects went down. But it was still based on the doubling dose in the mice. And then within recent years, they've done a complete reassessment and decided that most of the mouse data is not relevant and that it's multifactorial diseases that are important. So it's gone down and down and down. And meanwhile, carcinogenesis has gone up and up and up. And the interesting thing, I think, is to say that I don't want to contradict anything Elaine said, but the maximum permissible dose for occupational exposure in 1950 was 5 Roentgens. And the maximum permissible dose now in 2006 is 50 millisievert, which is the same thing. So the maximum permissible dose has remained the same from 1950 to now, except that the reason for it has totally changed. It used to be heritable effects. Now is carcinogenesis. Now, I admit that before that, the conditions became maximum permissible doses went down, but the most you can have in 1 year has remained the same for half a century. So with that in mind, let's look at how this has come about. Hereditary effects can be Mendelian, where you can see the pattern of going from one generation to the next. They can be chromosomal, or they can be multifactorial. Now, Mendelian can be autosomal dominance, where you've got to have a mutation in a single gene. They can be autosomal recessive, where the defective copy has got to come from both parents, and therefore that can be delayed many generations before it's expressed. And, of course, some of these are gender-linked, since males have only one X chromosome, so there are some problems that males have that females don't have. Now, multifactorial, if you look back to the Beer reports of the 1980s, and even the Beer 5 of 1990, they said that probably multifactorial diseases may be important, but we have absolutely no idea how to assess their importance, so we're going to ignore them, which they did. Now, multifactorial diseases are diseases that are known to have a genetic component, but the transmission isn't simple, it isn't Mendelian. And it's just about everything from cleft palate to hypertension to coronary heart disease. All these things have got a genetic component, and therefore, in principle, they could be affected by radiation. Now, as I said, after World War II, the then Atomic Energy Commission spent a lot of money on experiments with mice. They looked at skeletal mutations in mice because you could see those mutations without killing the mouse, but they weren't very important. The big one was the Mega Mouse Project, where they used 7 million mice and measured mutation rates by looking at a number of specific locus mutations. And these mutations were nearly all coat color changes, except for one other that was a shortened ear. So they were the experiments that cost the U.S. taxpayer millions and millions of dollars. And they came up with a number of conclusions which have found their way, some of them, into genetic counseling in general. First of all, they found that different mutations differ a lot in their sensitivity to radiation. That was an empirical observation at the time. Since then, all of the genes have been cloned, and we know that it's just that the genes are different sizes, so it's no surprise that they have different sensitivity to radiation. The next, which at the time was very important, that the mouse showed a big dose rate effect, so that if you spread the dose out, you got fewer mutations. And that was the opposite of Drosophila, which always caused problems because there was no dose rate effect. And there's the dose rate effect shown in mouse spermatogonia. If you just reduce the dose rate a bit, you get fewer mutations. And then, this one almost invalidated the whole thing. They found that the male is more sensitive than the female. In fact, at low dose rate, there were no mutations observed in the female at all. And this led some people, particularly the Drosophila geneticists, to say that this shouldn't have been called the Mega Mouse Project, it should have been called the Mickey Mouse Project, because they shouldn't have chosen the mouse, because in the mouse, unlike most other mammalian species, the oocytes are very, very sensitive to radiation. And so even a very small dose kills all the oocytes. And if you do that, you don't get any mutations. So in fact, all of the data is in the male. There are no data in the female from the Mega Mouse Project. And then, an important one, the genetic consequences of a given dose can be greatly reduced if a time interval is allowed between irradiation and conception. And if you say, well, how long should you wait? Well, it depends who's asking. If it's a little brown mouse, you say 6 weeks because the experiment was done. If it's a human, we don't know, but by analogy, you would guess 6 months. So that's part of genetic counseling. If you've had a big dose of radiation from diagnostic tests, you should wait 6 months before planned conception. You can practice in between, but you shouldn't have a planned conception. And then lastly, and this was the data that was used for years and years and years, generations of board questions to radiologists are based on this. The doubling dose, that is the dose required to double the spontaneous rate, UNSCARE from the start said 1 gray and stuck to it. The Beer Committee gave a range 0.5 to 2.5 gray. So that's the doubling dose. But now, recently, really, it's the UNSCARE report of 2000 and the subsequent ICRP publications have revised the whole business of heritable effects. And they pointed out that in order to get an estimate of the radiation risks in the humans, what you need is a baseline spontaneous mutation rate, which we've got, and then we need a doubling dose in the human, which we haven't got, but we've got one in the mouse. So we'll have to assume that the mouse and the human's the same. And so then they said, yes, but wait a minute. We've used this mouse data for the last 40 years, but it's wrong, because there are two correction factors you've got to make which almost wipe it out. Namely, one, not all mutations lead to disease. In fact, nearly all mutations don't lead to disease. So you've got to correct for that. In fact, you see, for chronic multifactorial, it's less than 1% of mutations actually lead to a disease. And then the other point, the other correction factor, is they said that the specific locus mutations that they studied are not representative because they must be well away from any gene that is required for viability. So that's not representative. So they've corrected for both of these things. And I'm not going to go through their calculations, but this is what they've come up with, ICRP, that the risk of hereditary effects for a working population is 0.1%, perceive it, and a total population, because that includes children, is double that, 0.2%, perceive it. And they come up with these figures by assuming a life expectancy of 75 years, which I resent, and a population doubling of 30 years, which is okay. So anyway, this is the point I want to come up with, that the risk of hereditary factors has gone down and down and down and down, and they're going to have to revise the tissue weighting factors. In fact, ICRP have already done that, but it hasn't percolated down to our national NCRP yet. So I started off by saying that the risks were almost all from animal experiments. Well, they're not quite all, because the children, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, have been studied coming and going for the last 60 years. They studied all of the classic possible endpoints, like untoward pregnancy outcome, death of live-born children, sex chromosome abnormalities. And then, since they had to get into the new age, they looked at electrophoretic variants of blood proteins. And basically, they found that they all had doubling doses here that they estimated. However, none of them was statistically significant. They all included infinity in their standard error. And so the statement is made that children of the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki show no indication of any significant genetic abnormalities. Now, how does that square with the animal data? Well, animal experiments show that a large doses cause abnormalities in offspring if you use 7 million mice to do the experiment. There's no detectable increase in mutations in the first generation offspring of the Japanese, which is 70,000 strong. And of course, the mouse geneticists say, if they'd only used 70,000 mice, they wouldn't have found any statistically significant data either. So I think we must assume that high doses of radiation can cause heritable effects, but the risks are very, very low. And so lastly, again, Dr. Brenner mentioned this. There's a score sheet for these untoward effects of radiation. And top of the league, Manchester United, Arsenal, and Liverpool, mental retardation during this sensitive period, 40% perceive it. There's about an order of magnitude in going down to fatal cancers, where for workers at low dose and low dose rate, it's about 4%, 10 times less. And heritable effects in workers, it's more than an order of magnitude now. It used to be an order of magnitude, but they've reduced it further, and it's down to only 0.1% perceive it. So I think that we've caught up with some of the things we missed out of previous courses. I'd be happy to entertain a question if there is one. What do you mean a reference? I mean the three numbers? Well, there isn't one. You've got to put together the three studies. There's the mental retardation. There's the Japanese survivors for fatal cancers, and then there's the ICRP heritable. So they're three separate things. That last slide pulls together the three different studies.
Given the fact, based
Well, the story, this is not my area, the story is that what happens is that the radiation is effective 8 to 15 weeks, is during the time that the cells are migrating from one place to another. That's the time when they are sensitive. So it appears to be an effect on stopping cells moving rather than killing a proportion of them, because the argument is that if you irradiate earlier than 8 weeks, there aren't that many cells and they aren't moving, and if you kill a few of them, they can regenerate and replace. And later, the sensitivity goes because they're all in functional place and they're differentiated and they're fairly resistant. It's while they're moving that they're sensitive. That's the explanation that is offered. Whether that is true or not, whether that is the whole story, I don't think anybody knows. But that is if you look for what events are going on in 8 to 15 weeks, what are the unusual, the unique events, and it's this migration. Okay?
Thanks, sir. You want to bring the microphone? Okay.
See, it's not. I can't hear anything in the speakers.
This should just have to. So it's not working at all.
These are still working.
Testing. Test. Right. It's working a little. Is there a volume knob? Carl, could you call the guy? I guess you called the audiovisual person. They'll come down. Can you yell? Let's see. I wonder if somebody muted it.
Test 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Mic check.
We'll leave this here, put it in your pocket, and this needs to be this clipped in here. Okay,
our
next speaker will be Ann Norwood from the Uniformed Services University. She will be speaking about the anticipated psychological impact of radiologic terrorism. So let's see if we get you set up here. And so.
Is that okay?
Fast forward, reverse.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here with you today. First, I wanted to get a little audience participation. I noticed following all the debates, I usually have like a green, yellow, red light. Probably need a cattle prod, too, but they don't have that. So if someone would just, you know, give me this sign like 5 minutes before my time is up, I'll get you out for the break on time. I'll be citing some references in here, but I want to, at the beginning, acknowledge the influence of Arnfinn Turnesen and Lars Weiseth, who are Norwegian scientists, psychiatrists, and psychologists. They really have done a great job of synthesizing a lot of the literature on psychological effects. I think some of the caveats that were in the other presentations about confounds is that there are lots of confounds when we talk about behavioral and psychological issue. One is trying to extrapolate from other cultures, for example. Another is extrapolating from historical examples into the present, especially with advent of internet and messaging and things like that. So just with that by way of background. Well, I like to think of the reason that psychological issues are important for a couple of different ways. One is that if people are too overwhelmed by feelings, they're not very good at problem solving. We already know that people under crisis situations do not remember information very well, and so that messages have to be very short and concise so that people can remember them.
Has an interactive effect with how one appraises a danger around them. If we hear information and we're already anxious, we might over-appraise a particular hazard or danger. It does fear, for example, anxiety, affect physiological response. Kind of the thing that I focused mostly on in terms of these kinds of issues at a large scale is really behaviors of groups and individuals. I mean, as a psychiatrist, I'm interested long-term how people do, but for this kind of event, I'm interested in people's behaviors in the initial hours and days, because that can either go and help the response or it can impede the response. And the last part of my talk would be talking a little bit about communications, because, again, for large-scale incidents like these, communications really is going to have a huge effect on psychological and behavioral responses. Now, despite whatever kind of disaster occurs, whether it be natural, technological, or intentional, there are certain basic assumptions we walk around with in life, for most of us anyway. There are certainly a lot of people that maybe don't believe it's a just world, but a lot of Americans kind of do at some level. Also, most of us have a healthy denial of hazards and risks. I mean, if you read about all the accidents, how you can get killed in your kitchen or your bathroom, you'd never get out of bed if you were really always aware of that. We also like, in terms of planning, a certain order and predictability to go around in life, that you take off in your car for work, that you're going to get there in one piece, and so forth. Also meaning, and that's really what a lot of what I think therapists do for something, is to help people take meaning from whatever bad thing happens to them. Now, terrorism, as a lot of people have underscored, has a lot of different goals, but one is to influence behavior by generating terror, ideally. I think if you think of, for example, the stock market, a lot of that is perceptions. There's no absolute to measure by. It's people's perception of what the economy is going to do and this and that. So it's no real kind of rational system of looking at specific indicators and coming up with, the stock should be at such and such. I mean, that's one factor, price earnings ratios or whatever. But also a lot depends on what people think is going to happen. So I just want to point out that psychological stuff really is in a lot of parts of our daily routine. I think the initial response we would see from an IND and RDD is a lot of what we see in other kinds of terrorist events or natural disasters. There's intense fear, especially for loved ones. I mean, we're concerned about ourselves, but I think we need to remember that most human beings, truly, we are social organisms, and we're altruistic, and we want to make sure that those we love and care for are all right. There's that sense of shock, like this can't be happening. That's pretty typical. Also, depending on the circumstances, horror, if we think back to the World Trade Center and people jumping out of the windows. Anxiety, there's this kind of unsettling, what's going to happen next? And I think specifically for this topic, remember back to anthrax. It will not be confined to the city in which the attack occurs, but all over our country, and in fact over the world probably, there will be that waiting for the other shoe to drop phenomenon. And one of the difficulties in reassuring people is that you can't say it wasn't somewhere else. In other words, we can't just put a wand up and say, well, no, there have been no other attacks and no other ones are going to take place. So you're going to be working in a background of everybody being on edge. And again, as we saw in anthrax, a lot of people, you know, would report white powder and all that. And that, I don't think, will be different for this either. There's a very strong urge to be with loved ones or at home when something bad happens to us. It's just kind of how we're hardwired, I would suggest. Is there just something comforting about, sort of like comfort food, about being with people you love and trust. And the other thing that characterizes these events are the intense hunger for information. And I think for most of us, if we think back to 2001, how we were just transfixed by television or radio or internet to find out what was going on. And also to point out that there's a lot of confusion in the beginning, and there were reports here, for example, the State Department being bombed and so forth. So there will be a chaotic environment where it's going to be hard to get accurate information. As I noted earlier, there's a diminished ability to retain and process information when we're in a crisis, and that's why, again, directions need to be very simple and be able to be repeated often. And finally, one of the things that I think is one of the most intolerable human states is uncertainty. We just do not like uncertainty. If you think of patients you've had that are waiting for the results of some sort of test for cancer, for example, once they have a diagnosis and a way to go forward, in a perverse kind of way, if they know they have something bad, that kind of in some ways helps to have that, for most people, to have that information. Now, does anyone recognize this? I bet a lot of people know this quote. Okay? But I don't know that many know the second part of it. And that talks about nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. So again, having fear is normal. It's adaptive. There used to be talk in the military of wanting to develop a pill that would kill fear, which would be a pretty stupid invention because fear is good. It prevents you from walking out in the middle of a battlefield saying, you know, I'm going to gun you all down. It's just, it has an adaptive purpose. So I think, again, what we need to do is when we think of fear, this is kind of my Goldilocks model, where you don't want too much because you don't want people to kind of behave like a stampede of horses. And you don't want too little because people will just deny what's going on or be apathetic and never bother to show up for treatment. But you want to keep kind of right in here where there's enough fear or anxiety that people would follow along with self-protective measures, ideally to comply or adhere to good advice and to help others rather than being focused on themselves. Now, mass panic does occur, but it's very, very rare. And again, as I said, it's sort of a stampede phenomenon, like in horses, but for humans, although it's often used to describe that internal sense of, oh, gosh, I don't know what to do. So helping people get back into that to avoid mass panic, if you can remind them of a social role, like I'm a mother or I'm a father, it helps them guide their activities. But again, it is quite rare. Things that are risk factors include the belief that there's a small chance of escape from the agent. So, for example, the crowded theater where fire is noted, if you can get out an emergency exit, people may not do it in an orderly way if they have panic. There's also the sense that one is at high risk for something bad happening. Another way people might panic, if you will, is that if they know there's only so much of a countermeasure available and it's first come, first serve, again, you're setting up a situation where you're more likely to induce panic. Also a sense that there's no perceived effective response that, well, think back to Katrina, you're kind of on your own, that no one's got it together. And an important one, too, I think, is the loss of credibility by authorities. I think over a number of disasters, we've seen, for example, initially in the anthrax, for a number of reasons, we lost credibility. Part of that was we had too much faith in what we thought we knew about anthrax. That changed over time as we got more information. For example, the idea that you had to have lots and lots of spores, that it couldn't go through an envelope through the actual paper, and so forth. So I think it always behooves us to be somewhat modest and undersell what we know. I mean, to be accurate about what we know, but just to anticipate there will be surprises that we haven't thought of. In terms of radiation in particular, one of the things that happened after Chernobyl was that a lot of people thought it would be sort of a homogeneous spread, like was seen after atomic testing and so forth. And that led to some mistakes. For example, in Oslo, Norway, they measured in Oslo and didn't see anything, so they reassured Norwegians that things were okay, and then it turned out it wasn't that way, which I'll discuss a little bit later. Some of the fear or terror-producing aspects of radiation is that you can't detect it by your own senses. You can't see, smell, hear, and so forth. And you have to rely on other people with special equipment to tell you whether or not you've been exposed or are contaminated. We'll talk more about symptoms later on, but I think if you heard already, there are some that are pretty generic symptoms. And then again, the whole issue of uncertainty. Have I, haven't I been exposed? When will we know? Is there a threshold effect? Is there not a threshold effect? Other aspects, again, we've heard about the heritable problems associated potentially with radiation exposure, and that's one that we've seen across a wide number of technological and other kinds of events where there's a fear for our offspring. Also, of course, the worries about carcinogenesis as well. Contamination, there's kind of some magical thinking about contamination, which is very much allied with stigma, in that even if you think back, maybe not so much now, but I'd say even a couple decades ago, when people had cancer, there was a sense of other people wanting to stay away from them for fear they would catch it. And there still is, I think, some of that residual kind of fear about things like cancer or radiation potentially. Now, risk perception and fear, I think, are important. And this is Slovic, who's one of the real leaders in the field of risk perception. Whereas technologically sophisticated analysts employ risk assessment to evaluate hazards, the majority of citizens rely on intuitive risk judgments, typically called risk perceptions. So it's not totally scientifically based. There are a lot of other factors that go into that. And some of the things that have been shown by risk perception research is that they're embedded in psychological, social, and cultural factors. So again, some of the cautions about extrapolating from one, say, lower socioeconomic to higher socioeconomic, other cultures, and so forth. And that we're very much impacted by what the people who are important to us, our opinion leaders, friends, family, tell us. And that we do know how people make sense of hazards and risks. We've studied that across a wide number of events. Some of the factors that affect risk perception, and some of these I'll also tell you also impact how people respond psychologically. And things that are voluntary, again, if you have a sense of control, it's less scary than if you don't. If it's familiar, if it's something you know, like car crashes or plane crashes even, that's less scary than something more exotic. One of the things, if you look back, for example, World War I, the first time gas was used or machine guns were used, very seasoned troops panicked. They just took off. But after a while, they became accustomed to it and then, you know, behaved like they would under other situations. So anything that's kind of out of the realm or having a plane serve as a bomb, if you will, going into the World Trade Center, again, that adds a certain amount of fear. Things that are intentional, like terrorism, have a much more profound psychological bump and also affect a sense of being more vulnerable to something bad happening. Again, statistics are ways that most of us, for populations, make decisions, but your average person, and maybe we ourselves sometimes, are also very much affected by the anecdote, the person we know who, or the human interest story on television or in the paper. Again, something that's there all the time, we don't worry as much about as something that comes in. Unfairly distributed versus fairly distributed. So if some people perhaps say who are poor are more affected by it than not, that may make us feel more worried. And this is something that's common across all disasters. When children are involved, the psychological pain and the worry is just so much higher. And that's something that truly I don't think anyone does get used to. Anecdotally, a lot of the responders at Oklahoma City, a lot of them retired after that or moved into more managerial jobs. So I think there are certain things that we really never really adjust to, and children are one of those. So if you think of targets, if someone targets, say, a daycare center or a school, that's likely to have much more profound impact than if they choose something with adults. And this is just showing you, we talked a little bit about how people aren't necessarily really rational when it comes to radiation. And I think a lot of that is because of the scary stuff that people who didn't like nuclear power plants put out there. But you can just see that, you know, here's the discrepancy between experts think in terms of the hazard versus a League of Women Voters. I'm not sure what year that was collected. I know they still exist, though. Other issues related to radiation include that it's poorly understood outside of limited professional groups. Most there are a number of people here that are very, you know, expert in their field, and so that they're more familiar with it. But, you know, even if you talk to a biologist or a chemist, they're not necessarily up on radiation. And there's still some controversy, I think you'll see. And obviously when something bad happens, the press, the media always likes to have, you know, informed, you know, differences of opinion, some for, you know, to have that kind of debate going on. And also you're just all these cowboys will come out of the woods that may not be well respected within the scientific community or may well be, depending on the event. And again, just the lack of being able to predict really well. One of the things that people like to say is that you have to actually measure your way out of a radiation event, because you can do all the plume modeling and so forth, but in the end, it may have higher concentration in one area or another given weather patterns and all that, and so you just have to measure to see where it all ends up. Now, again, physiologic reaction to anxiety produces a lot of very real signs and symptoms. And this can be problematic. A lot of people use the term worried well, which I really don't like. I think it's a pejorative term, much like radiophobia was coined by the Soviets for people who were concerned about the impact of Chernobyl. And I think that, well, I'll show a study of Guyana, but again, these are very common symptoms. And if you start to go through your checkbook of what sorts of symptoms one would expect, and you see these popping up, I think one might say it's worth checking out. And again, we give discrepant messages. For example, one of the powerful ones that Mayor Giuliani and others have picked up is using an abundance of caution, blah, 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 an abundance of caution. But if you, the average person, think you might have been exposed to something and you use an abundance of caution to just check it out, you can be perceived as worried well or a problem. So I would submit to you that those are kind of normal human concerns that isn't necessarily a problem. What might be a problem is figuring out how to address those needs in a way that doesn't overwhelm a capacity to put triage, to put the most ill in first. But I think that's a troubling concern to me when people just talk about worried well. I guess part of it, to show my own psychopathology, I think of myself as somewhat reasonable. And some of these things I would think, well, you know, I would probably check into it. It doesn't hurt anything, but I may wait till it's a suitable time. One of the problems with the autonomic arousal that may occur is, again, that normal physical symptoms accompanying anxiety or fear are interpreted as representing that one has been contaminated. And it's increased by rumors and false information. And again, the media has a lot of a role in getting out initial communications and either stoking fear or in helping provide accurate information that most likely will help people make better informed, less charged decisions. There's a kind of vulnerable time when, like, a bomb goes off where people are somewhat more suggestible, that if you tell them go there, they'll kind of just follow you because they're still kind of stunned. And, again, as I said, people want simple instructions after something really horrible has happened. The major interventions that I'll talk about a little bit are risk communication. And, again, one part of that is always following up on rumors. As soon as you hear it, you get out there, check it out, and put up something that says this is not true if it's not. We heard a little bit about Goiânia, Brazil, where a couple scavengers broke into an abandoned clinic, a radiotherapy clinic, and took the housing with a cesium-137, later broke it open in a poor part of the city, and because it was observed that it glowed, it came to be kind of a popular thing to play with. A couple weeks later, one of the women who was noticed these symptoms, went into a local physician, and initially thought it was some sort of chemical contaminant, but eventually they came up with radiation. Long story, short is not too many were, as we saw earlier, were contaminated, and only, well, not only, but four died from this overall. 12.5% of the population, as we heard, has showed up to be Geiger counter to make sure they were, you know, to see if they had been contaminated. And they did sort of prioritize for people that they thought were in the more likely to be, have been exposed. They did do them first and did find through histories, really, that helped them figure out places it had been. For example, on currency wasn't something they had thought about originally, and sort of figured out the epidemiology of the spread. Now, some of it, again, you might say worried well, but part of the reason was that even some physicians were asking for some sort of official certificate to show that people weren't contaminated. So there are lots of things that drive behavior, but certainly we can do things that kind of increase or decrease the kinds of behaviors we want to see. As I said, a lot of this, as we remember some of the symptoms of the transient skin erythema and so forth, nausea, diarrhea, things that you can expect to see. And so it's not surprising, I think, that a fair number of them, about a tenth, presented with these classic symptoms or symptoms consistent with radiation exposure and contamination. And this is just a more detailed talking about the different kinds of things. And then, again, retrospective memory is not the most accurate way to do it, and some of these had misperceived that they had been exposed before news even came out. So when we're anxious, we're not always very good historians, and maybe not even when we're not anxious. Now, what are the sort of responses from individuals and communities? As I mentioned, altruism really is a hallmark of most events. The usual very first responders are bystanders when something bad happens. You can recall at Murrah Building or any number of things how people rush in to try to help, help extricate people and so forth. So that really is a very pronounced human desire. Now, I think there are certain things that can make one less altruistic, like thinking you're going to die because of your altruism, but a lot of that at the time, I think, is not so rational a choice. Other things that can come through adversity and mastering it is a sense of resilience. Other common reactions are anger, anything that disrupts our normal predictability we're angry about to begin with, but then if you add in the idea of terrorists, you know, killing thousands of people, that gets us pretty angry. Often you'll see scapegoating, kind of you blame someone, maybe not even necessarily the people that did it. Stigma, discrimination, paranoia, loss of faith in social institutions and government. And the thing about loss of faith is that sometimes we in the government do things that kind of set us up to not be trusted. Breakdown of social networks and isolation. And finally, demoralization, where there's sort of a sense of helplessness and just sort of turning inward and giving up. And that's something, again, that we certainly don't want to see happen. Now, these are just a couple examples of stigma. Again, the journalists and journalism in this particular part was very much sensationalized and scared the pants off a lot of people. But they did encourage some, I would say, not so altruistic behavior, such as stoning the hearse that carried the 4-year-old girl who had died, or 6-year-old girl who had died. And I think she was contaminated by eating a peanut butter sandwich, if I recall correctly. So that, again, is not the kind of behavior we want to see. Other things, again, perceptions. Now, certainly one of the fears people have and concerns after one of these things, where there's fallout, is contamination of milk, food sources, water. But also there, even once one has bounded the problem, there still can be some irrational fear. And you saw here, and if you remember back to following 9/11 in Washington, how tourism stopped and so forth. So some of it's rational, and some of it may not be quite as rational. And there were even planes that would fly around Guyana just because they didn't want to go over the province, just in any chance that they could be exposed to something. And this is one thing I really like. It must be emphasized that this situation was not simply a case of ignorant peasants flopping around in confusion. For example, doctors and dentists trained in the U.S. routinely refused to treat patients without certificates. Unlike other emergencies, nurses refused to return from strike to treat contaminated individuals. And this is something I think if you look at analogs, for example, there was an outbreak of plague in Surat, India, and some of the first people on the trains out of Surat were physicians and in private practice. So I think, again, we all have to be careful when we label others or project things onto them. Three Mile Island, there was a partial meltdown of the reactor core in a nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. A very small release of radioactivity, and I know some of you experts can correct me, but I believe it was equivalent to probably one chess film or something like that on the order. There were no deaths, no injuries, but there were periods through the incident which were characterized by a sudden wave of new concern as they would vented some of the pressure from the reactor and things like that. So it was kind of like stepwise concern. The governor, because of the teratogenic effects, encouraged pregnant women to leave the area, a certain circumscribed area. But then that got other people thinking, well, if they're leaving, maybe I should leave too. So you have to be very careful when you give people guidance to kind of explain why and why that may not be important for others. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the studies that came out on Three Mile Island, because there are some of the lesser confounds than, say, looking at World War II in Japan. One study, Houts et al., did a telephone survey and interviewed about over 1,000 people living within 5 miles of TMI between 4 and 10 months after the accident, and they found that there was a higher rate of distress from those closer to the reactor. Dennis Maletti and colleagues looked at a nice design. They looked at official statistics of psychiatric admissions, suicide, motor vehicle crashes, and cardiovascular death and alcohol consumption within 10-mile radius of Three Mile Island. And what they did is looked at the period 6 months before the accident and 6 months after. And interestingly, the only statistically significant finding was an increase in alcohol sales after Three Mile Island, which may tell you something about the coping patterns in that particular part of the country, although maybe it wouldn't be that different here. Something bad. Okay. Another real famous studies were by Andy Baum and colleagues, who's now at Pittsburgh. One of the things they did was a 10-year longitudinal study where they followed 95 subjects over a 10-year period. 53 lived within the 5-mile zone, 27 lived about 80 miles away, and then 16 lived next to a coal-powered plant, not a nuclear plant. And they used a variety of different measures, I won't go into, psychological measures. But the thing that I think was really struck people is that higher distress levels lasted up to 5 years after the event, and that there were elevations in blood pressure, hypertension, catecholamine levels for more than 10 years. Now, just to jump back to Guyana, one of the interesting studies there that was done was compared the reactions of people who were in the impacted area versus those who were in another town, Abadia, where they took all the nuclear waste, I mean the radioactive contaminated dirt and stuff. They took it to a site in this other town, and they were both equally distressed. So it was the idea that there's a threat here that can influence your health and those you love. And another very good investigator, Evelyn Bromet, had the interesting opportunity to study both Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And a consistent finding were that there's a subpopulation after radiation that we need to be prepared to help deal with things, and that is there's a subcategory of mothers with young children who display initial very high levels of distress and persist with that distress years later. So for them, probably a more active outreach where you're reaching out to them with information and intervening perhaps with a combined medical psychiatric kind of approach, it may be a way to help them. The good news in all this, though, is both in Three Mile Island and in Chernobyl, the mother's fears about their kids' health didn't influence the kids. They did fine. So it's really the mothers that we would be treating in this, not the children. Chernobyl, again, the reaction in the nuclear power plant. One of the interesting things I read was that talk about denial. It took about 4 hours before the people at the plant really realized and could accept that the nuclear plant, it didn't contain it, that the radiation had leaked out. So, extremely large release in contrast to Three Mile Island. Whoops, got my wrong sticker here. We heard a little bit about the acute response and then the thyroid cancer long term. There were multiple confounds. First of all, the Soviet Union wasn't real transparent, as they say, with information. And the way that the rest of the world found out was because in Norway, one of the guys who worked in one of their nuclear power plants was walking into work and set off alarms. And at first they thought they had had a breach in the nuclear power plant in Norway, but it turns out he had trekked in some contaminated dirt on his shoes or on his clothes. So then that led back to finding out what had happened. And as you recall, the Soviet Union at that time wasn't particularly truthful necessarily with its people. You think back to the incidents where anthrax was released and all these people died in a village and, you know, never heard about it at the time. So needless to say, the people there didn't trust their government a whole lot. Another confound was that so many people were evacuated. An evacuation, we've learned over a number of studies, carries some psychological negative effects in and of itself, you know, over and above that whatever the event was that caused people to evacuate. But again, as I said, that they saw some increases in somatization, you know, worried about your health, depression, anxiety, and symptoms of post-traumatic stress in the decade after a disaster. Now, I really want to emphasize the importance of communication in these events. And it really is, communication is a two-way process, which we sometimes forget. And for those of you who are interested in this topic, I would really recommend that you check out the CDC site. They have a very robust, very expert group that deals in communication, and there's training you can get on crisis and emergency risk communication. So I think it behooves us all. They've also got a series of messages they've developed for most of the threats du jour for the first few hours following something. Like, you know, most people first want to know about protective actions they can take, and then later as things evolve, they want other things. But it's a good first, I think, a good first step in being prepared about what kinds of messages you might say as a health authority. But I just want to underscore a couple of things about this. Is one, the nearly impossible time constraint. So you don't have a lot of time to sit up and do a literature review and so forth. You know, people want answers and they want them now, which I think is the beauty of REM and some of the other tools that have been developed. Also, to accept the imperfect nature of choices. I mean, again, when we're Monday morning quarterbacking this, we'll say, "Yep, we shouldn't have done that or shouldn't have recommended that." But at the time, you're doing the best you can with the information you have. And so I think also letting people know that, you know, you're human, this is what you know, this is what you don't know, this is what you're doing to find out what's going on is very important. And again, just to how it differs from normal, say, health communications. Sometimes the things you, if you tell someone to leave and that turns out to be bad advice, you don't have a do-over in life, unfortunately. And again, there's just going to be a lot of uncertainty at the time, and you will not have a complete picture. Again, think back to the World Trade Center, where people said go back to the building, which I'll mention in another kind of study, actually. And this is, again, where I said we've had some opportunities to find out how not to do things, and remember the controversy that's been really talked about lately about when the EPA said it's fine to breathe the air in New York City. And probably there were parts of New York City where that probably wasn't such a good advice. So I think one of the reasons I don't actually like to put reassurance as a thing that we do as officials is because I think of reassurance as a byproduct of our actions. If we have an effective response, if we give people information that's accurate to the best of our knowledge, it may not be reassuring if you're someone who's going to have bad stuff happen to you. But people do appreciate candor, and once you've blown your credibility, it's very, very difficult to get it back. Again, back to the anthrax example, when Secretary Thompson at the time was kind of just off the cuff saying, well, he probably caught it when he was out fishing in the stream or something. And then later, you know, people just didn't have the same trust they might have otherwise had. So again, it's a two-way process, and there's something also called self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you're so focused on reassurance and calming panic, you may actually precipitate what you don't want. So I think it's better just to emphasize what's going on, tell them what you're doing, acknowledge the uncertainty. Yes, we're all worried. These are the things we'll do to try to explain what we do know. Giving people things to do, especially if they're productive things, sometimes just to manage anxiety. Things that I learned when I was a new psychiatrist in the Army was the Vietnam era wives taught me a lot. And what they, one of the things they said was, we had a helicopter that crashed in Germany from one of our folks at Fort Hood. And again, this was before there was instantaneous communication. So the battalion commander's wife met with the wives, they were all male personnel at that time, and, you know, explained that press is going to come out with stuff that isn't going to be right. And then she was right. Initially, they reported one death, and there had been no deaths. So by giving them that kind of, you know, sort of roadmap of what to expect, and also suggesting, like, if they're really worried, turn off the TV, turn off the radio, clean up your closet or something, something where you can kind of do something useful and just kind of distract yourself. And then you express wishes, you know, how I wish I could tell you that it's safe here or it's safe there, but it's going to take X number of hours to find out. This is how we're going to do it. Acknowledge the shared misery. You know, we're all suffering for whatever worries. This anticipatory guidance, it's kind of to me like when you're, you know, a really good physician, nurse, they're giving medications, when they tell the patient the side effects that are common, and then the patient experiences them, it kind of gives them trust in you that you know what you're doing. The other thing about that I want to go back to in terms of psychology is, remember the power of the placebo effect. If you believe something and you have a sense of confidence in people, that just helps things go more smoothly. But it's a very delicate balance of not saying something with certainty that really isn't, and being very careful about what you promise to people in these circumstances. And then, you know, the idea of walk the walk in addition to talking the talk. Now, I think some of the challenges we would face is the kind of complexity that we saw today of how radiation works and how its health effects occur. And that's very difficult to get down to a sixth grade reading level, which really is what messages need to target people at. Also, for those that are illiterate or read in a different language, whenever you can, just having like cartoons or something that is a visual that you don't really have to understand that much is helpful. And again, explaining the long-term effects. For example, to a lot of us, it might be reassuring to hear, well, your overall risk will only increase by 10%. But for a lot of people, that isn't so reassuring. So you have to also remember your audience and how that might be perceived and when you're crafting these kinds of things. And then again, the forecasting, whoops, and explaining changes in scientific understanding. As I said, again, we saw a lot with anthrax that changed. And I think we would find the same would hold true with some sort of RDD and for sure with an IND reaction. There'd be things that we just didn't think of or didn't know that we would learn over time, because that's been the case with other things that have happened historically. Now, I just want to talk about, I don't have a slide on it, but there was another way to look at data, again, analogs, historical examples, but also there have been some surveys that have been done of how people, what they would want to know or how they think they would behave. One series of interviews and focus groups was done by Steve Becker and his group as part of the monies that were given to the schools of public health to help develop pre-incident messages, the idea of trying to educate people ahead of time about what to do and understanding the threat. So he's written that report. And it's really valuable, I think, because we all think we understand how we say something simple that people would understand, but one of the terms that's bandied about is shelter in place. And it turned out that for a small percentage of people, they didn't know what you meant. Like, do I go to a Red Cross shelter, or what does that mean? So I think it's very important to try out our messages ahead of time when people aren't really dealing with it in the heat of the moment. Another really good example, I think, was from Roz Lasker's New York Academy of Medicine study in conjunction with other folks on redefining readiness. And what they did is sent out 2,400-plus random adult surveys, and they oversampled African-Americans and the 9/11 cities, Washington and New York, to kind of feel how people would react to either smallpox or an RDD. And the interesting thing is that about 68% of people would follow the advice of the government and officials to shelter in place initially. 59% of those would stay as long as they were told to stay. 20% would want more information, and 11% would leave immediately. Now, when you ask the people why they would leave, some of the reasons were that usually it's because they were concerned about a loved one, especially children, like 33% would go because of that. Or others, competing needs, for example, picking up medication or food would drive them to leave. And then there's, of course, a small subsection that's just contrary, and you're not going to do anything to affect them. They're just going to leave for whatever reason. They think they can avoid the radioactive fallout or whatever. But some of the other interesting things are looking at, from an emergency perspective, of things we can do to influence behaviors. And one of the very strong needs that people talked about was wanting to find out if everyone's okay. So having communications like telephones available to check in with their loved ones, or knowing that the places of work or the schools had a plan to take care of their loved ones was also very reassuring and made them more likely to stay. So I think these are important things that as emergency managers in our plans, whether it be in our own hospitals or workplaces, to make sure that we have this kind of information available or influencing others, that there are things that we can do that make it more likely for people to comply with our recommendations, and there are things that we can do that pretty much are going to guarantee you're going to decrease compliance. So again, I think all the early messaging would focus pretty much on protective measures people can take. Anticipatory guidance, again, to the extent you can forecast, like with side effects, you're building a sense of trust. And even providing, the information that likely you're going to hear dueling experts over the next few days and weeks. And this is one of the ways you might think about it. For example, if this guy is selling his countermeasure on the internet for only $9.95, you may put less faith in him than someone who really has no ox to gore in that particular situation. Again, just providing guidance. Everyone's going to be angry and scared, but it doesn't mean you go out and beat someone who looks like they might be from the Middle East. The provision of rapid, effective triage and treatment. And again, I think this leads us to a discussion we had about the biodosimetry. And I will say that for the Norwegian, the Somi are the reindeer herders. And they were the group that actually, it turns out, they had a lot of fallout get into their lichen, which is part of what the reindeer eat, and then they eat the reindeer and use their skins. So for them, it was a real threat not only to the health, but to the way of life. And they did whole body counters on them periodically to let them know how they were doing vis-a-vis radiation and, of course, surveying the lichen and all that. And another important risk communication came out of the Norwegian experience as well, where, first of all, they were put this message out that it's okay for your kids to go out and play now. Things are safe. But keep your cows in the barn. Now, can you think where it's kind of like the duct tape and plastic, it didn't go over very well. So, again, I think for some of these, it's nice to run them by, like, your average person and see, they give you that kind of weird look, like, what happened to you? But also then to give a rationale for why you're recommending certain things. So it's not just asking people to take it on blind faith. In terms of the hyperarousal, if people are still ginned up, a realistic reassurance, that, the country isn't going to fall apart because part of Washington, D.C. is contaminated. Probably some people might be reassured by that fact alone. But, again, just to treat symptoms as needed. Sleep, for most people, after World Trade Center, I think like 92% of it, maybe higher than that, 97% of Americans had initial signs of distress. But for the vast majority, they do go away over time. The other interesting study with Roz Lasker is the New Yorkers. Boy, they're a paranoid bunch. But also, because their experience had been, if you listened to people at 9/11, you were the ones that went back to your office and swooshed. So they were very, very much more reluctant to take people's words on things and really need a lot more data on which to make their decisions. So, again, I think And there are certain populations, too, for example, African Americans, based on poor communication of why staffers on the Hill were getting Cipro and they weren't, and the whole issue of antivirals in the background of Tuskegee. And then, what we saw in Katrina, you really have to think through being transparent and being honest, and, you know, if something's screwed up, saying it's screwed up with people to have them trust you. So again, misattribution of somatic symptoms, doing outreach to those who have a lot of somatic concerns and that are very anxious. Of course, surveillance and monitoring, contact high concern vulnerable individuals on a regular basis. And I think most people, me included, and another thing that we saw after the anthrax attacks is one of my colleagues up in New York, one of the networks came over, called them and said, please come over and see our people. They're very distressed. We just found out we've been exposed to anthrax. Well, no one wanted to talk to him. They wanted an infectious disease specialist, someone to say, you know, they didn't want to hear about how do you feel about potentially being exposed to anthrax. So, again, I think in this kind of setting, you don't want to give people a sense that it's radiophobia or all in their head. So you really want to integrate, have an informed medical practice that relies, works closely hand in glove with your behavioral health specialist in order to really and we'll make mistakes. We may tell someone they're fine and it turns out, well, oops, we didn't know there was a really heavy bit of contamination in one of those parts of the city. And again, just in terms of how our minds work, that which is clearly known hath less terror than that which is but hinted at and guessed. And that's by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And for anyone who likes Sherlock Holmes, you know, you've got to listen to what he says. Finally, this is sort of a segue to Steve's talk later, and says, oh, God, it's going to be one of those days. And for those of us who work in preparedness planning, this is starting to resemble me more and more every day. It's just kind of the worry about the threat du jour, whether it be pandemic flu or a dirty bomb. But at any rate, thank you all for paying attention.
Thank you, that was great.